is given a remedy, even if there's been good faith in the arbitration procedure, the way the bill is written, the consumer will be not just entitled to, but would also be required to be awarded treble damages.
No, I don't read the bill that way. Also, I should say the current law provides that even if the arbitration process occurs and that consumer feels that they have not received proper or thorough or complete remedy, they have the option to go to court. We are talking about arbitration that has not occurred. This, the treble damages provisions.
Well, I'm looking at subsection 1 of section 5, which says that if the consumer appeals from the decision of the arbitration panel to a court, and the court grants, and the consumer hadn't been granted a remedy, and the court grants a remedy, then the court shall also award treble damages. So, what you really want, as I understand it, is if there was bad faith in the arbitration process, then the court should award treble damages. Okay,
that's
I think
correct.
I understand what you want, but I don't think this quite says that because I don't think so. But in any event, if it would be a court function then to determine whether there was the bad faith element, that would be a part of the court proceeding. Who determines that issue? Would it be the court?
Well, I would think that would be through the court proceeding.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And then one last question, Mr. Chair, is
Senator Fry.
I just noticed the other day, Representative Jolin, within the last two or three days, the state of Washington passed a revised Lemon Law. I haven't seen it, but there was an article in the paper about it. I just wondered if you'd seen it.
I briefly looked at that, Senator Fry, and interestingly enough, some of the provisions that I can recall, by the way, I read that article during the debate on a little non-controversial bill involving workers' compensation reform. And one of the provisions in there is that the manufacturers must provide an automatic 24,000-mile warranty, which was quite intriguing to me. That's really much stiffer than anything we require in our law. If, in fact, a automobile, truck, or car is found to be a lemon, they cannot be resold. I found that quite intriguing. Actually, all in all, I would suggest to you that Washington's law and other states also have much more severe provisions in their laws as they relate to lemon law or consumer protection than what we propose to do here today.
Senator Kinnemer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jolin, I guess I'm still confused, and as I heard your discussion with Senator Fry about this, it sounds to me like you're saying that treble damages are in some regards discretionary or something. As I read the bill, any time anyone finds that the arbitrators, who I understand are lay people, have not acted in good faith, as the court deems that to be, that automatically they receive treble damages. And I guess I'm also assuming that's treble damages for the full value of the vehicle. Is this correct?
That could potentially be for the full value of the vehicle, for a remedy that may involve a certain major component of that vehicle, whether it be a clutch or whatever the problem might have been, faulty hood, faulty brakes, whatever the case may be.
So it would be triple whatever damages they were sustaining
mm-hmm.
with the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. And I guess it would be an automatic just treble damages, period. There is no other resolution of the problem?
Once you got to that point, when all had been tried, that is the arbitration process, if that was not accomplished in good faith, every hoop had been climbed through, and the end result was to end up in court, and that consumer made their case in front of a judge, possibly a jury. I've never been involved in such suits, and a consumer may have a choice in that. In fact, if the consumer prevailed, they could receive treble damages.
I guess the question is, they could receive treble damages, and that's what I'm trying to get at. Is if I understand the, you know, I don't know, that's what I'm trying to find out. Shall also be awarded three times the amount of any damages. Does that mean they could be awarded triple damages, or they would automatically be awarded triple damages?
Well, I think the key, and if this bill does not explain it well enough, that should be clarified. I think the key is good faith. If good faith actions did not occur in the process, whether that be in the arbitration process and then when one finally concluded in a court system and it was established by the judge that good faith had not occurred throughout all of these proceedings, that in fact at that point treble damages would come into play.
I guess another thing I'd like to know from you is why select treble damages per se? I guess my sense, you know, I mean, I have no problem. If somebody has a lemon and they've been mistreated, you know, I think somebody ought to pay. I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering about the arbitrariness of selecting treble. Why not quadruple or double or some other number? Why that automatic number? And if I read the bill correctly, why not discretion of the court? It's why I have wondered about maybe some permissive language that would suggest treble damages as the standard rather than as the requirement. So that there's some discretion made. Why an automatic treble damage? Why not up to triple damages or something like that?
If I may, Senator Hill, Mr. Chair, I have with me John Studenval, who represents Augsburg,
mm-hmm.
and was a requester of this bill, and possibly he can give you further insight.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, I'd like to address that in a couple ways. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members. My name is John Studenval. I'm with Augsburg. Mr. Chair, Senator Kenemer, in the first place, the treble damage language is consistent with language in Massachusetts, for example, which Representative Jolin alluded to earlier. Massachusetts is considered by many to have the strongest lemon law in the country. We made the language in our House Bill 2599 consistent with language that's in the current Massachusetts and the original Massachusetts lemon law. And secondly, Mr. Chair, Senator Kenemer, I think a point that's been missing so far is the current statute states that arbitration panels shall deduct from the consumer award a reasonable amount for the consumer's good use of the vehicle. Excuse me. We believe that leaves a good deal of discretion to the court. In other words, if a consumer does go through arbitration, does not receive a full purchase price refund or a new vehicle, that does not at all mean necessarily that the arbitration panel acted in good faith. The arbitration panel may have made a reasonable deduction for the consumer's good use of the vehicle. It would certainly be the intent that the court would take that into consideration when considering a final ruling on whether the arbitration panel acted in good faith, whether treble damages shall become operative.
Senator Kenemer.
Excuse me. Mr. Studenval, I guess I'm a little dense today. I still don't understand the answer to my question. Now, let me try and frame this a little differently, maybe with an example. Let's suppose that that I have a car that I believe is a lemon, and I pursue the process. Let's say it's a $20,000 vehicle, and we put 10,000 miles on it during the course of this, and it's in the shop more than the required days, and so on and so on. And basically, as far as I'm concerned, the thing is a piece of junk. And the arbitrator says that's not true. And I take this to court then ultimately because I pursued all of the avenues to get redress. I believe I should have another vehicle mm-hmm. or my money back or something. When I go to court now, will I receive three times $20,000, my purchase price automatically if I prevail, less usage of the vehicle or some or is there some discretion? You know, let's suppose that they decide that I'm a personality disordered individual and I'm just hard to get along with, and I wouldn't be pleased with Rolls Royce or anything else, and you know, I'm just one of those nasty guys that can never be pleased and a perfectionist by nature, and I didn't have the world's best car, and it wasn't put together the world's best way, but maybe part of the lemon resides with the owner rather than with the vehicle. Is there any discretion there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kenemer, absolutely, and I think you've pointed it out here, and I apologize if I didn't explain my earlier answer clearly enough. Due to the nature of the current statute, due to the nature that the consumer's recovery in arbitration shall be less a reasonable amount of the consumer's good usage on the vehicle. As you said, that gives the court a good deal of discretion in deciding, in the first place, whether the arbitration panel acted in good faith, and secondly, whether the court shall hold in the consumer's favor at all. For example, if a consumer, as in your scenario, if a consumer has a $20,000 vehicle that has 10,000 miles on it, let's say, for example, that 5,000 of those miles are considered by the arbitration panel to be good usage, therefore the arbitration panel deducts those 5,000 miles of good usage from the consumer's monetary award. Consumer isn't happy with that and goes to court. The court can, in fact, given the way the House Bill 2599 is written, the court could easily hold that the arbitration panel acted in good faith. The consumer, in fact, does not even have a reasonable position to bring the case to court. Therefore, the court would not hold in the consumer's favor and would rather say you, the consumer, received adequate recovery through arbitration. Since the court did not hold in the consumer's favor, treble damages simply would not come into play.
I'm sorry to prolong this, Mr. Chairman, but I still have some questions.
Let me, excuse me, Senator. Is there a requirement of bad faith before treble damages can be awarded? Is that what you want?
Mr. Chair, that language specifically is, excuse me, is not in the current statute.
Well, is that what you would require, though?
That would be the intent, yes.
Well, is that language in the bill?
Not specifically, no.
Well, then we'd want it in the bill, right? Is that it? Well, I want you to tell me what you want so we can get the...
Sure.
As I see it, there's no requirement of finding of bad faith in the bill. Now, we'd want that in, right? Or tell me.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, as someone once said, we would want that made perfectly clear.
Okay. Senator Kimmerer, if that was in the bill, would that...
I think that's pretty much it. I still might have some question about automatic... You know, I think there may be degrees of bad faith. Sometimes you have a slip-up. Sometimes you just deliberately are putting the screws to somebody. You know, and that raises some questions about automatic treble damages. My suggestion, for what it's worth, is I'd like to see maybe a guideline of suggesting triple damages, but make it maybe permissive, because... I don't know.
Well,
but bad faith certainly goes a long ways towards answering my concern.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I don't mean to prolong
this. Representative Jolin.
But the whole intent of this bill is to have that economic incentive.
Absolutely.
That heavy hammer. If you provide for permissive language, I guess I'd ask you a question, Senator, in all good faith and respect. What would be the incentive for the manufacturer to do any better than what past history has proven? And that's been a very poor job. But I think further, if you clarify wherever it takes in this measure that what we're talking about is bad faith, clearly define that, I think you've covered your concerns, and I don't think that you'd ever see by making that perfectly clear, I don't think that you'd ever see the treble damage provisions abused. I don't have some of the fears that some of you expressed today. However, we are in a process of compromise and establishing our intent clearly, and I think that is important.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I guess I certainly would support the intent. Somebody's wrong, they deserve redress. I just think it's maybe a bit arbitrary to say it's automatically three times. You know, maybe it's two times. Maybe it's five times. I don't know how much agony somebody goes through in this situation. I've certainly had my fair share of, in my mind, lemons, but not really, I guess, by this standard, thankfully. And I can imagine it's extremely irritating. And I don't know what's fair. I just think we usually ask the courts to make an assessment of that, and I wonder about the wisdom of the legislature making an a priori decision about what that's worth without regard to the specifics of any given one case. Now,
Mr.
if they've
Chair.
Been through bad faith, you know, I understand that they have really thoroughly been wronged. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem with them being compensated for that. They certainly deserve it. It's just a question of how do you deliver that compensation.
Well, I think we have the intent down, and if there's any amendments that are needed, because we certainly want to keep with the intent of the bill, but if there are some amendments that needed, if we want to be able to have some finding of bad faith, I would assume. If that's it, we can come up with some language to that effect, then Representative Jolin, we'd be happy to come up with that language and show it to you and see if it meets your satisfaction. Bring the bill back at the work session and then take action on it at that time.
Chair,
Senator Simmons.
I have one concern, too, that hasn't been covered. I'm a great believer in awarding a prevailing party in a lawsuit costs and attorney's fees. I think that goes a long way toward eliminating frivolous lawsuits. And where a person's already gone through, presumably in good faith, this arbitration procedure, and then decides to file a lawsuit because, as Senator Kennedy indicated, he might be a particularly irascible and hard to please person, and then the court finds that the manufacturer did act in good faith and that no damages are to be awarded, isn't it only reasonable that the manufacturer then be awarded his costs and fees? It seemed to me what's good for one is good for the other. And if you're trying to eliminate needless litigation, the best way to do that is to make each party responsible for the other's costs if he loses.
Mr. Chair, Senator Simmons, just like to address that in a couple ways, if I might. In the first place, the consumer is required to jump through a large number of hoops, if you will, to even get to that stage. Is required to own the vehicle for a substantial period of time, to document the fact that it is a lemon, to proceed through an arbitration process before the consumer can even think about going to court. And secondly, we think, as Representative Jolin said, we think we need to send a very clear signal to the auto manufacturers that they need to provide good faith arbitration mechanisms.
But isn't it equally as important to send a signal to the individual that, as Senator Kennedy described, that you just can't harass and harass and harass and have somebody else pay for it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Simmons, if I might just finish my previous point. We think it's very important to send a clear signal to the manufacturers to say that you need to provide good faith arbitration mechanisms, and the only method that we've been able to devise to do that is to place these economic incentives on the manufacturers to provide these good faith mechanisms. One such way is the treble damages. What we've got now is a situation where consumers say to themselves, I can't take on General Motors, I can't take on Audi or Subaru or whomever it might be. They have a vast array of attorneys who are very good in these situations. I'm just one little consumer. We think if we insert the prevailing party language as you describe it, we're going to place ourselves in the situation where we're in now, where consumers will not be able to take on General Motors, where again, the consumers will be up against a vast array of attorneys and very specialized legal people against one little consumer.
Well, I would think the attorney that was consulted would know whether there was a valid case or not, and if he felt that he could collect his fees, he'd take it. Or maybe most of these will be handled through legal aid anyway.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Simmons, I think that's a very good point. And the language in House Bill 2599 awards attorney fees and costs to the consumer only if the consumer prevails in a court action.
But if the consumer has a case that has no merit and pursues it anyway, then the manufacturer is out his cost of defense. And, of course, that all adds to the price of the next car he sells or the next 100 cars he sells. So as a consumer bill, it seems to me that you should protect the consumer against unwarranted expense on the part of the manufacturer by putting the reciprocal arrangement on attorney's fees.
I think we have the issue defined right now. So, and when we bring this issue up for work session, Senator Simmons, we may can entertain an amendment to that effect. But I think we have the picture. Now, are there any other issues? As I understand, two issues with this bill right now. All right. Anything further?
Weren't the good faith, the treble damages, and the attorney's fees on both sides?
Yes. All right.
Okay.
Okay, and we'll deal with those issues when we bring the bill back up for work session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We'll now move back to our hearings on Senate Bill 1034. And I do intend to go through the rest of the agenda by 3 o'clock. So I'd ask people to have their testimony succinct as possible. Please do not repeat testimony. First witness will be Dan Smith.
Mr. Chair, and for the record, my name is Dan Smith from the Administrative State Building Codes Division. I know you've entertained quite a bit of testimony on this bill, and I'll try to keep mine brief. I do have written testimony. I'll try to just cover that testimony briefly and would be willing to respond to any questions. I suppose to start with, if you'll permit, what the Building Codes Division does for the record, and we essentially deal with any type of construction that takes place in the state of Oregon. When I say deal with it, we regulate it, we license tradespeople, and we license much of the equipment. To give you a brief overview of how we came to be, in 1973, through Senate Bill 73, the creation of the Building Codes Division took place, which brought which is now some 14 codes to be administered by my division. Those deal with the plumbing, electrical, mechanical, boilers, elevators, mobile homes, and the various types of construction that takes place. Our responsibility is to enforce the laws and to adopt rules for the administration and licensing of the tradespeople. The division is assisted by 9 boards and committees, which are made up by 82 public members. We have a certification training section where we certify inspectors and building officials throughout the state. We review plans for construction, we issue permits, and provide inspection for compliance to the codes. If I might, give you a brief resume of my experience in the business, so I hope it'll lead some credence to why I support this bill. I've been in the industry for over 40 years. I started out as a laborer, worked into a tradesman, up through the foreman, superintendent, owning my own construction company. I've spent the last 12 years on the enforcement side, administration of the various codes. I've worked both at the city and county level and in state service in those functions. I'm certified by the state of Oregon as an A-level inspector, structural inspector, plan reviewer, building official, plumbing inspector, mechanical inspector. I'm also certified by the International Conference of Building Officials. I'm Oregon's representative to the National Conference of States on Building Codes and Standards. I'm on the state's advisory committee to the International Conference of Building Officials. These functions provide us input from Oregon to the model codes that are adopted throughout the United States. In the past few years, I have been involved with the Economic Development Department. One of the major projects was the $60 million plant to be constructed by NKK in Millersburg. I think that it proved advantageous to be able to work upfront with those people. We worked with the engineers and the people who were to construct the building, making known to them the codes that would be required in the construction of that facility. At the same time, Economic Development was working with the company on all the other aspects of alluring them into Oregon. The project, as it progressed, we continued to work together all the time so that there was no misunderstanding of the codes that would be adopted, that are adopted in Oregon, that they would have to comply to. One of those advantages was accomplished in Senate Bill 73 when we adopted a statewide code. That permitted us to work at the state level with Economic Development and other entities to address all their concerns regardless of where they built in the state of Oregon, because the code is intended to be uniform throughout the state. We have also worked with a firm from Japan, Oshio, which is now breaking ground to build a new plant in Newburgh. As an example, my electrical inspector will be in Japan, I believe in the next week, to go over some of the facilities there prior to them moving over here to make sure that everything complies. I've also had my boiler inspectors sent to Germany, to Korea, and to Taiwan on the same mission. So we do work with these companies up front, and we provide this a service to them. And speaking now as an ex-builder, I remember when I was to start a large project that I needed to know all the regulations that was going to face me. And I was building in Oregon prior to the adoption of a statewide code. So it became very necessary to whatever town or city I was going to build in that I found out what regulations took place there, as well as going to my financial institution to see whether I got the money to do the job or not. I perceive that somewhat the same thing with us working with Economic Development, that we can give industry all their answers up front, working together. An additional benefit to the Building Codes Division itself through this passage will permit the Building Codes Division to operate much more economically. This may not be realized in the first biennium, but in future bienniums it will. For example, when I look at the cost in supporting the director's office, I can take probably about half of that cost in one biennium, automate the Building Codes Division. We can do all of our own functions. That is a one-time cost. So our expenses to support the administrative services that's now provided through the director's office would be drastically reduced. I believe that this move is not only good business sense, as well as political sense, as I would relate back to my working with and different managers in my section working with Economic Development in the projects that are already started up in Oregon. I have attached to my testimony some of the functions that we do within the division only for your information. And being as the rest of my testimony is written, I'll try to keep this brief and would be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions, Mr. Smith? Senator Coyne.
How many people do you bring along with the Building Codes Division total?
Mr. Chair, Senator Coyne, we now are just over 100.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
One
Senator
question,
Simmons?
Division was created with the passage bill of Senate Bill 73. What year was that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Simmons, in 1973.
73.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Smith.
Thank you.
Yes, we have several people. I think they're all, perhaps could all come up together. Steve Wynn, Bert Gleaves, Bonnie Pound, and Jim Larpentier. If not, you can come up individually. Steve Wynn first.
Single identifiable agency dedicated to business in this state. Such an agency requires the direction of a policymaking commissioner with a perspective on the needs of businesses in Oregon. As for where a corporation division should be housed, there are logical reasons for it being placed in the Secretary of State's office, the new finance and insurance division, or in the Department of Economic Development, and we could support any of these. However, we believe it would be an anomaly to introduce a fee-generating enterprise such as business registry, securities registration, into the Attorney General's office. As the Attorney General told you a couple of weeks ago, that office is essentially a law firm. The practice of law is incompatible with running an endeavor such as registering business entities. As long as the Corporation Division is kept intact, we see it functioning effectively under the Secretary of State or either of the Executive Department agencies. We defer to your perspective on the policy considerations that go into assigning the agency to a department.
Ms. Pound.
Thank you. I'm Jim Larpentier, a business lawyer practicing in Portland. I am the current chairman of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar. Previous speakers and correspondents more than adequately express our position on the substance of the issue of dismantling the Corporation Division. The principal purpose of my testimony is to attempt to establish credibility for those of us who have appeared in support of maintaining the Corporation Division intact in this state. The business law section represents approximately 1,200 lawyers in this state, each of whom maintains an interest in the business side of practicing law. As such, it is part of our function to deal often with the Corporation Division, whether it be business registry functions, security registration functions, or business law regulation, including securities law enforcement. A 15-member executive committee constitutes the governing board of the section. At a recent meeting of the executive committee, the subject of the provisions of SB 1034 that would separate the business registry functions from the securities registry and enforcement functions was thoroughly discussed by the executive committee. We unanimously voted in favor of our opposing the dismantling of the Corporation Division and beseeching this committee to maintain the Corporation Division intact. Lawyers participating in that discussion and vote practice in Medford, there were two of them, Albany, Hood River, Beaverton, and Eugene, as well as Portland. This includes Stuart Foster, who did such a fine job for us with respect to Senate Bill 303. I think it's unfortunate that those of us who have expressed our concern about dividing the spoils, if you will, between the Office of the Secretary of State and the Department of Justice do so as voluntary advisors to the Corporation Division who are concerned that we will lose access to decision makers. Why should I join in taking shots at Dave Frohnmeyer, a gentleman with whom I have great admiration? But obviously, that's exactly what we're doing in terms of the position. I think that the history of voluntarism in the public interest among the business lawyers of this state is irrefutable evidence that our sole goal is to improve the business laws of this state. I have personally been involved in the development of legislation which led to the adoption of the original Model Business Corporation Act, the modified version of the Uniform Securities Act, the Uniform Limited Partnership Act, the Modified Limited Partnership Act, and now the revised Model Business Corporation Act. And I am certainly not alone in those efforts to adopt legislation which I consider to be progressive. And I think that any comments that denigrates that effort on the part of the business lawyers of this state are really out of line. We're trying to retain a system that works well. We are major users of the system. So maybe we are a special interest group, but no more so than any other industry whose operations will be severely impacted by proposed legislation. We ought to be given credit for knowing what we're talking about. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. We'll now close our hearings on Senate Bill 1034. And now, as Representative Fallbush will now move into hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 3222. House Bill 3222. I don't think so. Okay.
It's Hood River again.
Hey, we only produce top quality stuff. Mr. Chairman, if you're ready, we're ready.
Yes.
See, if you got the amended, is he handing out the amended version?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, here's my statement.
Yeah, why don't you hand that out? You want us to be brief, Mr. Chair?
Yes, thank you, Representative.
I had a feeling you did.
Mr. Chair, they can be as long as they want, but we won't be here after 3 o'clock.
Then we'll be real brief. For the record, Mr. Chairman, Wayne Fallbush on House Bill 3222. This is a bill that corrects an anomaly in the statutes. Some would say something that might be unfair. And at the same time provides a unique opportunity for diversified agricultural product. Now, I know that doesn't necessarily look like an agricultural product, but it is made.
Are those exhibits that will be turned over to the committee?
Mr. Chair, the OLCC is sitting here with us, and there might be a violation. But if you would like to see me in the office afterwards, I'm sure we can arrange for something.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
Just trying to facilitate the process. What this bill does, real simply, is we have a unique manufacturer started up in the state of Oregon. It is Clear Creek Distillery. They make a high-quality brandy that is unique. It is not a flavored brandy. It is a pure distillate, much like German schnapps, I believe. And it is a high-quality product using an increasing number of Oregon Bartlett pears grown in Hood River Valley, if I may add, at the McCarthy's family farm. This bill simply allows that if you produce brandy, distill brandy in Oregon, and you wish to be able to taste and sell that product from your own distillery, that you may be licensed by the OLCC to do that. It will allow you to sell only the product that you distill. The amendments, Mr. Chair, that are suggested would allow one additional, and I think you have, do you have the copy that
hand
has
and gross.
The hand and gross version. Those simply will allow and one additional off-premise site to be licensed by the OLCC for the purposes of tasting and advertising this product. That's what the amendments do. And the bill, again, simply allows the OLCC to license the manufacturer of brandy in Oregon to sell on premise. The problem basically is that Mr. McCarthy, when he developed this product, in order to allow people to taste it, he had to go down to the liquor store to buy a bottle and bring it back and have people taste it. And he simply would like to be able to sell limited amounts of his product from the distillery the same way that wineries today are allowed to sell their product from their wineries, and they also, I believe, under current law, have the ability to sell off-premise in selected locations. This bill would put a distiller of brandy within Oregon basically on the same plane as operating level as the wineries already have today. That's basically what the bill does, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Do you have a limit on how much the microbreweries have a limit? I don't see any limit on this bill.
The gentleman from the OLCC will address that because that's a relevant point, Senator Cohen, to bring up. Right now, the product is in such demand that the OLCC is afraid that they're having a hard time supplying the need. And Mr. McCarthy can tell you a little bit about how he's trying to meet that. And they have a suggestion that when they write the rules will be written such that there can be no monopoly situation set up whereby Mr. McCarthy would control the market on his own product.
Another question for the purposes of... you also include hard cider. Does that mean that...
Oh, I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding
me.
Are
you going to start in the business with the little
Well,
hard cider?
That's, you know, if we can, I think it's always advisable if legislators can deal prospectively with opportunities that may arise. I had the occasion to spend several weeks on the continent this winter and found in England a very pleasant surprise in most of their pubs. In fact, in every pub that I visited, and I don't want to bore you with the number on that, people might get the wrong impression. But there were at least one or two taps in every pub of hard cider. It was a delicious product. It fit well. And we would like to be in a position of encouraging our local industry with that opportunity if they see fit. And this was an opportunity basically to write that into the law to be sure that it was that hard cider could be sold as a product in the state. Thank you for reminding me.
Shall I go?
Yes.
Mr.
Fine.
My name is Stephen McCarthy. I'm the proprietor of...
Just ignore that microphone. Oh, okay. You'll be fine.
Right. Of Clear Creek Distillery, and I've submitted a written statement which I'm kind of not going to read to you. This bottle contains about 40 pounds of Oregon Bartlett pears, and it is a product that is a pure distillate. I take the pears from the orchard that my brothers and I have outside of Hood River, crush them, and the book that you have illustrates the process. The pears are crushed in their entirety. Nothing is added, no flavors, no sugar or anything. Then it's distilled in a German pot still that I bought in Europe, and I've been working on this project for 10 years. And then it's bottled. So what you have here is only what came with the Bartlett pear, fermented and distilled. In many places in Europe, entire villages make their living on by producing these eau de vie or pure fruit brandies. There's one other outfit in North America, a fellow that I'm working with, that does this. There's only two of us at this point. The response in the market in Oregon has been absolutely fantastic. I need this ability to sell on a very limited basis at the distillery, primarily as a way of introducing the product to people. The stores, the Oregon State liquor stores, have been very supportive. There's no intention to compete with them. In order to provide enough product to satisfy the demand, I went to Germany in March, bought another pot still, two more fermentation tanks, and I plan on quadrupling my capacity this fall. I'll be using at least 200 tons of pears this fall, and that'll be the second year of production, and I expect that will double in the next year. I also plan on apple brandy. To conclude, it's a spectacular market for Oregon agricultural products. It's being very well received all over the country and in Europe. And I need this ability to properly introduce the product to people.
Any questions? Mike Reed.
Chairman Hill, members of the committee, my name is Mike Reed. I'm the Director of Regulation for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The Liquor Commission has no objection to the bill or to the proposed amendments to the bill. However, we do not want to notify the committee for the record of several assumptions that we are making in taking this position and of several concerns that we have about the implementation of this bill. This will be a new situation for us. We would not use a standard form contract for Mr. McCarthy as a liquor store operator or for anyone else who qualified under this bill, primarily because these liquor stores would sell only one product. The contract would probably contain terms which would require the distillery to ensure a sufficient supply statewide so that all Oregon citizens could obtain the product and so as to prevent the creation of a monopoly at this distillery. We do not presently allow tastings in liquor stores, and we assume that the legislative authorization here is not intended to authorize tastings in liquor stores except in these unique circumstances described in the bill for the purpose of promoting an Oregon product. Also, we normally allow any one person to have only one liquor store in order to give as many people as possible the opportunity to operate a liquor store. We assume that the legislative authorization here is not intended to authorize multiple liquor stores for any one person except in the very unique circumstances set forth in the bill. And finally, there are many complex details that will need to be worked out in setting up a liquor store in conjunction with a distillery. We need to work out some of these arrangements before we begin to look at a second location. Now, we have no objection to the legislature authorizing a second location for a liquor store and for tastings, but we assume that the legislative authorization does not require us to approve a second location until we can work out the problems of how to deal with shipping, freight costs, agent compensation, and so forth.
We're in complete agreement, Mr. Chairman, with those anticipated conditions.
Mr. Reed, are you sure that the bill does not need to be amended any further to take care of any concerns that you have?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that it does. The language of the bill at line 19 permits the distillery to apply for appointment as a retail sales agent of the commission. There is no guarantee that the application will be received, approved, and so forth, and that he or she will in fact be appointed. So it doesn't mandate the appointment. It simply talks about eligibility. And as long as there's no legislative intent to require it, we would simply treat it as an eligibility requirement.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Simmons.
Would you, Mr. McCarthy, I guess, would you anticipate that your second location might be at the location of your pear orchard to take advantage of Hood River's tourist business?
I think that's a good assumption. It's a little ways in the future. It seems to me like a good thing to do. I'd like to be able to take advantage of the Hood River Valley, much like some of the wineries have their premises, their tasting premises at the vineyard, conceivably in some of the things that are being done in Hood River now, some interesting attempts to use the old Diamond Fruit property and so on.
I would think, Mr. Chair, that the wind sailing ought to bring in a lot of prospective customers for it. Some of them get pretty warm and some get pretty cold. One second question. You're certainly not anticipating putting up a store of this kind a block or two away from another liquor store or present outlet.
No, it's...
And I doubt that the OLCC would permit that. Is that correct, Mr. Reed? I guess that's a question of each of them.
Proximity to existing.
Chairman, Senator Simmons, I think that's correct. We would not, if I understood your question, would we approve a second liquor outlet in close proximity to the first one?
Or to another OLCC outlet?
that is probably a correct assumption on your part, Senator Simmons, that unless the agent in that location agreed to it, we would probably want to locate the liquor store to better serve the public in an area that is not adequately served by an existing liquor store.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the amended versions would simply, or first off, if I may, on line 29, the word from on to off was a typo that was corrected on the House side. That is already an approved amendment. The other two's on line 17 and on line 19 are language that would be necessary to allow somewhere down the road a second outlet. That's really what the bill is about, Mr. Chairman. Your disclosure.
Any further questions? Discussions with the committee would like to have an opportunity. Anyone would like to have an opportunity to study this further.
Can I just talk a little bit?
Yes.
The hard cider piece. Doesn't say anything about it. Just allows any tavern to sell hard cider. Is that what you're?
Not even sure that's necessary.
Yeah. Senator Cohen, that is clarifying language. You could make an argument that it is not needed, that ability is there today. It is only stated in the statutes here to make it very clear that if somebody does want to start up and try to market hard cider in the state, that they will have the same access as any other spirit.
Okay, but your vision with this amendment is to put hard cider in the same classification as beer,
yeah.
In the sense that's
yes.
I just need it for my own purposes, yeah. To understand that you're not really talking about limiting it to the microbrewery chapters, but you're talking about just putting hard cider in the same classification as whatever the OLC will regulate in terms of sale of beer. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen. I informed Representative Farbush earlier this afternoon that if this legislation were to pass, the Liquor Commission would probably want to adopt an administrative rule defining hard cider to cover only cider that is fermented. I don't know if there's a process for distilling cider, but I know that the common terminology of hard cider is fermented cider, and that is what we would want to restrict, since it is in this legislation authorized in places that only have beer and wine licenses. So yes, it would be a fermented product, and it would be basically sold along in the same context as beer and wine.
Thank you.
It's the committee's pleasure.
Do you want to move the amendments?
Senator Cohen moves the amendments as proposed for House Bill 3222. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Move the bill.
Senator Kinnemer moves House Bill 3222 as amended to the floor. If it do pass, recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Cohen?
Aye.
Fry?
Kinnemer? Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye. Passes. Any volunteers for carrier? Senator Kinnemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your office is still standing.
Is that a full invitation?
Yes.
My apologies to those who are here for the rest of the bills. We did not get through as much as I had hoped and anticipated. But we have, three of us have hearings in another committee that we must go to right now. We'll roll the other bills over to the next possible work session, and my apologies. We are adjourned.
Next committee.